From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Yasser Arafat is reportedly fighting for his life in a Paris hospital tonight. The 75-year-old Palestinian leader left his Ramallah compound for the first time in nearly 3 years last Friday to seek urgent medical treatment for an undisclosed condition. Today, he was, for a time, reported dead. Arafat has devoted his life to the creation of a Palestinian state, critics say at any cost. He won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1994 with Shimon Peres and Yitzhak Rabin after the signing of the Oslo Peace Accords. When he accepted the prize, he stood rumpled and worn in the glittering crowd, and Palestinians loved him for it. But the promise of peace has dissolved since that hopeful hour in Oslo. Arafat has been blamed by Palestinians for corruption and mismanagement. He's been reviled by Israelis as a terrorist. George Bush has called for him to be pushed aside. But Arafat has persevered, even in the bombed-out desolation of his West Bank offices, until now, as he reportedly nears death, and even his closest supporters are forced to look beyond the most visible symbol of the Palestinians. Tonight on Point, Palestinians, Israelis, and Americans brace for life after Yasser Arafat. We begin tonight in Paris, where Glenn Frankel has been following Arafat's health for The Washington Post. Minutes ago, I asked him for the latest news on the Palestinian leader.
Well, things are very murky. A French military spokesman finally came out a few hours ago and told us that Arafat was still alive, told us that his condition had worsened and that he was being treated in a specialized unit, but that's all he had to say. Didn't answer any questions, didn't tell us any kind of sense of what Arafat was suffering from, and so he left as many questions as he answered. And as you probably know, all through the day there have been all these rumors about that he's dead or near dead or brain dead or, you know, on a respirator. None of these things have been denied except the actual fact of death at this point.
What is the source of all these rumors? Who's in the hospital with Yasser Arafat? Who's at his bedside?
Well, as far as we know, at the bedside itself is his wife, Suha. But there are a number of people from the Arafat entourage who are hanging around here, people who know him well and probably a few who don't know him so well. They're partly filling the gap, and it's partly all those worried, anxious Palestinian officials back in Ramallah in the West Bank. The fact is that Suha and the family seem to be determined to reveal as little information as possible. The normal press conference that the Palestinian diplomatic representative here has held each day never occurred today. So it left, you know, journalists and others just kind of hanging out there. And when it's Yasser Arafat, I mean, the entire Arab world is going crazy with rumor after rumor and, you know, what this means and the implications. And so it's easy for this stuff to get started and snowball. Plus, the Israeli media have joined in, and they were the first ones to say Arafat was dead. So you got this incredible swirl around this man. It's partly a result of the fact that he's the only Palestinian leader. There's an incredible vacuum once you get past him, and I think what you're seeing here, these rumors in part, reflect the great degree of anxiety that people are feeling about his demise.
We're reading reports of well-wishers holding a vigil outside the hospital this evening. Have you seen that? Can you describe the scene at the hospital, Glenn?
Well, it's just a couple of dozen people. They came very quietly after about 9 o'clock. They've got some posters and flags, and they've lit candles. But it's a very quiet, respectful little vigil. We talked to one or two of the folks there who just said, you know, I needed to come out. I'm feeling very anxious. He's our leader, and we don't know what's going to happen. So it's just one of those little things, but it's probably the most poignant and genuine event of the day.
And, of course, French President Jacques Chirac visited the hospital today as well. Why would he have come personally? And I guess the broader question, why did Yasser Arafat come to France? Why is he in a military hospital?
Well, France has always seen itself as having a special relationship with the Palestinian movement and a special relationship really with the Middle East. It's always tried to steer its own diplomatic policy there, while the United States, for example, has been refusing to meet with Arafat for the last couple of years and has seen him as an obstacle to peace. The French have continued to cultivate him. They see him as the only credible Palestinian leader, the elected head of Palestine, if you will. And so they've gone their own way on this. That's the reason why Chirac invited Arafat or agreed to the request from Arafat's family that Arafat be treated here. They took him to a military hospital because I think they got a rather good one southwest of Paris that could treat what they thought might be a blood disease or a cancer that he was suffering from, and at the same time be pretty discreet because it's in a compound and there's a big high wall around it and a lot of guards. So it's easy to seal it off and to deal with him in private. Chirac went today, I think, to pay his respects, again, to show that France has its own policy and its own way of going about things, and it tries very hard to keep good relations with Palestinians and with the Arab world in general.
And finally, Glenn, you described the murk around the precise state of Yasser Arafat's health. Are French journalists confident? Are you confident that if and when he dies, that this news will be made public in a timely way?
I'm not confident of anything right now, Tom, except when it happens, it'll happen, and we will find out sooner or later. I mean, you know, French journalists, I don't know if they know anything more than we do at this point. Palestinians have to decide how they're going to handle this. Mrs. Arafat has to decide, if you will, when she's willing to pull the plug, if he's on a respirator, on life support. And Palestinians have to decide how they're going to deal with it. But, you know, it's not the kind of thing they can keep secret for very many hours. Again, to me, it all reflects the incredible anxiety out there because for 40 years, this man has been the living symbol of Palestinian nationhood, of Palestinians' aspirations for nationhood. And he jealously guarded that role and made sure he had no successors. So when he goes, you know, it's going to be a very difficult moment, and I think people just aren't quite ready to face it yet. But who knows what tomorrow will bring.
But for now, the vigil goes on. Glenn Frankel, I know it's late there. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Glenn Frankel is a correspondent for The Washington Post. He spoke with me from Paris. We turn now to the West Bank, where Palestinian leaders have been meeting around the clock as Arafat's health declines. Harvey Morris is Jerusalem bureau chief for the Financial Times. He joins me now live from Ramallah. Harvey Morris, what are you seeing there today?
Well, not very much. I have to tell you, I can't really add much to what Glenn said about Arafat's condition at the moment. We're not really hearing much more here than is being put out in Paris. Ramallah is very calm. I mean, there are no sort of public demonstrations or manifestations of any sort about public concern of Arafat's condition. I think in Gaza, some people have turned out for demonstrations. But then Arafat is a Gazan, and Gaza is a much more militant place.
Is it believed, known, accepted that Arafat is at death's door in Ramallah? Is it the talk of the town?
I think, actually, you know, a week ago when Arafat left for Paris, and he was lifted out of his compound in Ramallah by a helicopter, there weren't too many people on the scene at the time then. Those people one did speak to said that they were very sad. He was the symbol of the nation, and they were sad to see him go, but most of them didn't think that they would see him come back.
Harvey Morris, describe for us, if you can, what appears to be emerging as a succession or a fight over succession if Yasser Arafat does not pull out of this critical health situation.
Well, what's been happening since last week, since Arafat left, is that the Prime Minister, Ahmed Kouray, and the Secretary-General of the PLO, Mahmoud Abbas, and various other officials from what one might call the old guard, the people who came back from exile with Arafat, have been taking over or establishing themselves in control of the reins of government, and have been trying to give the impression that there is a smooth transition or there is a smooth operation underway to safeguard continuity if and when Arafat should return or if he should die. Now, that has sort of held good all week. There have been no indications that there's going to be any power struggle of any kind. The Palestinian parliament met on Monday, and there were lots of good wishes for Arafat's recovery. There was very little of the criticism of Arafat and those around him that one's heard in the last year or so from some reformists. And so everyone's putting a very calm image on the situation. I think, however, if and when he dies or his death is confirmed, that then one will start seeing jockeying for power. And one also has to, of course, bear in mind the position of militant groups who are continuing to stage bombings and shootings against Israel.
And Harvey, finally, any word from the Israeli government today, from Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, on Yasser Arafat's condition or the Palestinian succession?
No. I mean, Sharon said that he wouldn't comment until there was some firm news. As you know, he's in the middle of his disengagement plan from Gaza, which he did not negotiate with the Palestinians, neither with Mr. Arafat nor those who are likely to be his successors. But if Mr. Arafat does die, I think Sharon will come under pressure, particularly from the left, who've been supporting him, to get back round the table with the Palestinians to discuss it.
Harvey Morris, thanks very much for joining us there tonight. Harvey Morris is Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. He spoke with me from Ramallah. We are talking tonight about Yasser Arafat's grave illness and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict after Arafat. You can join the conversation. What has Yasser Arafat stood for to you? Will his passing, if it comes, mean a better chance for peace or chaos? And what has this one man meant for Palestinians, for Israelis, for Americans? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Falls Church, Virginia, is Muhammad Abu Nimer, professor at the School of International Service at American University in Washington. He's author of Dialogue, Conflict, Resolution, and Change, The Case of Arabs and Jews in Israel. Muhammad Abu Nimer, thank you for being with us tonight.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure.
You are of Palestinian origin yourself. You're watching the same drama that the rest of the world is paying attention to, playing out in Paris, however unclear the exact health of Yasser Arafat may be at this moment. What are the stakes as Arafat apparently lies at death's door tonight?
Well, I think, you know, as you said earlier on in the introduction, the symbolism that Arafat reflects or expressed in his life towards the Palestinian struggle towards statehood or self-determination. So I think many people are anxious about the Palestinian cause and the Palestinian statehood, especially that with the illness of Arafat, you know, there is a threat that this might throw the whole statehood issue and the whole leadership issue into some chaos, and there will be more delays for a situation where it doesn't really need to be delayed further than that. So the stakes could be Palestinian national self-determination on the ground. Yet I think, you know, it's been over-exaggerated because Arafat himself as a political leader has been confined for the last 3 years in a semi-prison where his ability to rule or ability to even take decisions was completely limited or reduced. And really the people around him who have been managing the Palestinian affairs for the last 3 years. So on one hand, he's a symbol for the Palestinian national statehood and the struggle for the last 50 years. On the other hand, on the practical aspect of it politically, he really hasn't been making and calling all the shots in the last 2-3 years.
Muhammad Abu Nimer, there's a lot to talk about here tonight, but I just want to ask you, as a man, Palestinian born, your personal feelings about Arafat as he struggles for life tonight.
Well, you know, it's a mix of sadness, and to some extent, we were talking tonight actually over dinner here at our house, and you know, we both said really his departure from Palestine to Paris, and the whole treatment of his illness reflect and symbolizes the Palestinian struggle, you know, with the uncertainty, even in his death, with the uncertainty of the place where to bury him. In his death, he's relying on Israeli approval to be buried in Jerusalem. It's a very sad story, to be honest with you, for a Nobel Prize winner and for somebody who shifted from a military man to somebody who agreed to sit with Israeli negotiator. It's a very sad story.
Muhammad Abu Nimer, please stand by. We are talking tonight about life after Yasser Arafat, the Palestinian leader reportedly near death in Paris. You can join the conversation tonight. What has Yasser Arafat stood for to you? And will his passing mean a better chance for peace or chaos? How much difference has this one man made in Israeli-Palestinian relations? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about life after Yasser Arafat, the Palestinian leader reportedly struggling for life, reportedly near death tonight in Paris. We're joined tonight by Muhammad Abu Niber, professor at the American University in Washington, and now from New York by Henry Siegman. He's director of the U.S. Middle East Project at the Council on Foreign Relations, former executive director of the American Jewish Congress, author of Strengthening Palestinian Public Institutions. Henry Siegman, thanks for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
So here we are. No one knows exactly what will transpire and on what timetable, but as you know well, we already had reports today of Arafat's death, and none of the reports sound good. If we are indeed approaching the death of this iconic Palestinian leader, what does this mark in the long history of this bitter struggle and effort for peace between Israelis and Palestinians, Henry Siegman?
Well, as some people have indicated, there is a possibility now, albeit at the moment a theoretical possibility only, that the policy that Israel has pursued in recent years, and particularly this past year, of proceeding on its own and establishing the facts on the ground unilaterally without discussion with the Palestinians and without coordination with its leadership, and specifically in the context of the announced withdrawal by Prime Minister Sharon from Gaza. This is a withdrawal that was to be handled without any coordination with the Palestinians. The pretext or the reason given for this Israeli unilateralism was that there is no Palestinian partner for peace, and that then specifically Arafat is not a partner for peace, since it is inconceivable when Arafat is around that there would be negotiations without Arafat.
And this President Bush has essentially seconded, saying that he's calling on Palestinians to replace Yasser Arafat.
Exactly, exactly. Not only has President Bush endorsed the withdrawal, but he has endorsed its unilateral character. There was a letter that was presented to Prime Minister Sharon by the president on April 14th, in which the president recognized that certain facts on the ground have been created, which must be recognized and accepted by the Palestinians. So this unilateral policy was endorsed significantly by the president.
Do you see prospects for peace being enhanced or not if Arafat is leaving the scene?
Well, that is precisely the point. Since he's leaving the scene, the excuse, the reason, the pretext offered for this unilateralism should disappear. And in fact, Prime Minister Sharon has announced that if there is a new Palestinian leadership that will be addressing the issue of violence and terrorism and will seek to stop it, that he is prepared to resume a bilateral negotiation with that leadership and even to coordinate the Israeli withdrawal from Gaza, although he said he would not delay that withdrawal. So he has at least paid lip service to that kind of change of Israeli policy, but he's made it conditional on ending violence, on a complete reform of Palestinian institutions and a turn to democracy, and other such conditions.
Henry Siegman, Muhammad Abu Niber, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Aaron Miller. He has advised the last six secretaries of state in the United States on Arab-Israeli negotiations. He's president of Seeds of Peace, which was founded originally to bring together Israeli and Palestinian youth. Aaron Miller, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
I think you've spent time fairly recently on the West Bank and seen what's going on among the Palestinians. What's your sense of how what appears to quite possibly to be the imminent news of Arafat's death is going to be received there?
Well, I'm a historian by training. I mean, there's no doubt that we confront now one of the rare historical moments, both in the pursuit of Arab-Israeli negotiations and Middle East history. Whether Mr. Arafat is incapacitated for the long term or passes from the scene, you essentially are going to take out of the equation a man who has dominated the Palestinian national movement, who has access to more money, more guns, more political authority, and more international standing than any of his contemporaries have right now and are likely to have for the foreseeable future. So I think this will be a profound event. It will clearly influence the direction of leadership in the Palestinian national movement and could over time, I suspect, depending on what the American and Israeli reaction is, not just to Mr. Arafat's impending death, perhaps, but to the overall question of Arab-Israeli peace, it could have, over the next several months, or at least within the next year, 2005, a beneficial effect. I see three trends coming together, which for the first time in the last 4 years of nonstop terror and violence offer an opportunity to break out of the very tragic and cruel stalemate.
And those are?
Well, number one, you have a second Bush administration. And although this is counterintuitive, I believe that a second Bush administration, oddly, is positioned to make a serious move on this issue if they decide to make the issue a priority. There's no re-election politics. They've stored up enormous currency with the new Israeli government. Nobody could ever accuse them of being anti-Israel if they chose to spend some of this currency.
So Bush would have latitude if he chooses to use it in point two.
He would. And number three, which I think is even more intriguing, we will, I believe, begin to disengage from Iraq sometime over the next 18 months. And we will be looking for other issues that have regional resonance with our Arab and European allies in which to engage. There is no issue, and your guests will certainly verify this, with more regional resonance than the issue of Israeli-Palestinian peace. So I think a second Bush administration could, if it chose, adopt the position. Second is Mr. Arafat's passing. And here it's more complicated because it's not so much a question of formal succession. I think the succession, frankly, will be fairly smooth. Palestinians will borrow a page from Ben Franklin, who advised his revolutionary colleagues vis-a-vis the British that we're either going to hang separately or we're going to hang together.
Mm-hmm.
So I think unity will be the order of the day. The real question, though, is not the succession. The real question is who among Mr. Arafat's successors will have the authority and the legitimacy to act on the critical issues facing the Palestinian people and their national movement. And finally, there's the issue of Mr. Sharon. Now, with all of its shortcomings, Gaza withdrawal could conceivably be a bold and historic move if it's implemented comprehensively and if it's modified, and it may well be if the Palestinians can summon up an interlocutor, basically to be implemented, as Mr. Siegman said, with some sort of coordination and cooperation, and second, that it not appear to be Gaza first, Gaza last,
mm-hmm.
that it's linked in some fashion to the West Bank.
So, Aaron Miller, I know we have to let you go in just a minute here. In brief, your sense of the legacy of Yasser Arafat when he passes?
I think history will provide a mixed judgment. On one hand, they will credit him with single-handedly putting the Palestinian issue and cause on the political map. About that, there's no doubt. But I think the other judgment will be rather harsh and cruel. I mean, we've spent hundreds of hours negotiating with this man over the course of the past decade, and I suspect the cruel judgment will be that he had a very difficult time making the transition from a revolutionary diaspora leader to a leader capable of good governance and tactical smarts when it came to negotiations with the Israelis. The reality is, my final comment is, Mr. Arafat's transgression at Camp David was not that he didn't accept what Mr. Barak put on the table.
In 2000 with Bill Clinton, yeah.
His transgression was that he basically didn't negotiate in any meaningful sense of the word, and history will judge him, I believe, very unkindly for that.
Aaron Miller, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.
Aaron Miller, president of Seeds of Peace. Muhammad is calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Muhammad. You're on the air.
Thank you. Yeah, I just want to let you know that I'm an American Palestinian.
Yes.
And we're going to miss Arafat, and we learn how to love him since we are children. We're going to teach our children to love him and to respect him. And he's going to be like a nation in one and an army in one. We sometimes disagree with him, but we love him, we respect him. And the biggest mistake United States made that not to negotiate with him and isolated him, because no one in any any Palestinian leader can make a decision and make the whole people agree on it.
Mohammed, let me ask you, I can hear your affection as a Palestinian American for Yasser Arafat. Let me just ask you this, though. If indeed he is at death's door, if he passes, will prospects for peace be improved or not, in your view?
No, I don't think so, because the Israelis, they're not looking for peace. Look how the roadmap, many Israelis in the Sharon cabinet, they said it's gone and it's not exist anymore. And Yasser Arafat always said that he is looking for peace, and he needs the American and the European and Russia and United Nations to help to implement the roadmap on the ground. But the Bush administration refused and reject to talk to him, because that's what the Israelis want.
And there's a full-throated endorsement of Yasser Arafat, even at this hard hour for him. Mohammed, thanks very much for calling. Mohammed Abu Niber in Falls Church, Virginia, your sense of Arafat's legacy and how it may continue to affect efforts for peace in Israel and Palestine, even if he's out of the picture?
Well, I think, I agree with Aaron Miller when he said that there is no doubt that Arafat's legacy can be really summarized mainly in bringing the Palestinian national cause, the problem from being refugees and refugee camps and around the Arab world and the world, into the forefront of the international community, from his famous speech in 1974 in the United Nations up to his acceptance of Oslo Agreement. I think that legacy will continue to be present for many generations to come. And as you heard the other Mohammed, the caller, he said he's going to teach his children the same principle. And I think many Palestinians feel that despite the 3 years of confinement of Arafat and the harsh critique of his internal management of the Palestinian governance, nevertheless, this man is in the statue of Nelson Mandela, in the statue of any founding father of any national movements. I think that legacy is always there. With his absence, I think that many people will continue to debate whether is there any Palestinian leader who will be capable of delivering an agreement that relates to Jerusalem, to the refugees, or to the Palestinian national state boundary. Arafat could not deliver even on those, and he would not even sign on these three aspects. And I think the next leadership, which is already in place, by the way, there is all this talk about vacuum in leadership, which I don't think is accurate. You have Ahmed Korea, you have Abbas, you have many people already in position of leadership. The question whether Sharon and whether Bush will change their initial policy and make room for a new path for Middle East negotiation.
Mohammed Abu Niber, Henry Sigmund, stand by. I want to welcome to our conversation from New York Rashid Khalidi. He's professor of Arab Studies at Columbia University, director of Columbia's Middle East Institute, author of Resurrecting Empire. Rashid Khalidi, thanks for being with us tonight.
Oh, a pleasure.
You know well that both by the Israeli government in very harsh terms and by Washington under George W. Bush, Yasser Arafat has been branded as a real obstacle to peace at best, and a terrorist and murderer at worst, responsible in a supportive way for many acts of terrorism, and yet sitting there in peace processes. With Arafat's passing, if that's what we're about to witness here, what do you think is the fair judgment?
Well, the Bush administration and the Israeli government have used Arafat as a pretext for avoiding negotiations for a very long time. They've invested an enormous amount of energy, both of them, in demonizing Arafat and blaming everything under the sun on him.
But the bombings were real, the failure to negotiate...
The bombings were carried out in the main by Arafat's most dedicated political opponents, as everybody in Israel, including the Israeli intelligence services, know. Hamas does not act, nor does Islamic Jihad, at the behest of Yasser Arafat.
Mm-hmm.
Arafat can certainly be blamed for failing to rein it in. Arafat can certainly be blamed for many, many things. Arafat certainly was engaged in fighting a war against the Israelis for many, many years. There's no question of that. But the idea that the Israelis are pure as the driven snow in this, in a situation where, admittedly, 1,000 Israelis have been killed, most of them civilians in the past 4 years, but 3,300 Palestinians have been killed, most of them civilians in the same period, is ludicrous.
In that moment,
both sides are engaged in a conflict. Mm-hmm. The most powerful side, the side that's occupying all the territory of the other, is Israel. To place all the blame on the Palestinians in Arafat is obviously ludicrous.
And that moment that passed at Camp David, with Barack there, Bill Clinton there, Yasser Arafat there, you know that Yasser Arafat has emerged in many tellings as as the problem in that picture. What was his predicament there?
Well, I think we should go back and look at this, first of all, as something that's an American failure. President Clinton was in office for 96 months. In the last 5 or 6 months of his presidency, he finally devoted attention to solving the basic issues between the Palestinians and the Israelis that the Palestinians were not allowed to negotiate from the beginning of the peace process, even before President Clinton took office. In other words, refugees, borders, sovereignty, Jerusalem, water, settlements, all of these issues President Clinton did not allow the sides to deal with until Camp David at the end of July in his last year of office. So I think if we're going to apportion blame, maybe we should start with the greatest superpower in world history, which failed to deal in the 8 years of President Clinton's presidency with these very complex and difficult issues until the 11th hour, when the president was lamer than a lame duck, almost a dead duck. The second person I would blame is Prime Minister Barak, who came to the table, put forward essentially a take-it-or-leave-it proposal and said, I want you to sign an end-of-conflict agreement. Accept these terms and sign an end-of-conflict agreement. Now, Arafat, in my view, bears a large share of responsibility for many things, including what he did at Camp David. But for him to sign an end-of-conflict agreement in a situation where Barak was putting forward a take-it-or-leave-it a proposal that was perceived as unsatisfactory by most Palestinians, was something that was pretty much inconceivable. If he had agreed, he would have been discredited and rejected by his own people. What Barak was suggesting was that the West Bank be divided into three separate, discontinuous cantons, that Israel would control entry to and exit from them. And he was therefore, and these would all be separated, obviously, from the Gaza Strip. Now, if Barak had said, this is my opening position, let us start negotiating. We want to keep 10 or 12 or whatever percent of the West Bank. What do you say? It would have been one thing, but it was a take it or leave it proposition. I personally find President Clinton's and Barak's and President Clinton's senior advisor Dennis Ross's accounts of this very much self-serving, and I think very much intended to cover up their own failures. I could talk about many other things that Arafat is responsible for or bears the responsibility for, but I don't think he was primarily responsible for the failure of Camp David.
Rashid Khalidi, I know we have to let you go, but thank you so much for being with us for a few minutes on this evening.
Pleasure.
Rashid Khalidi, professor of Arab Studies at Columbia University. Henry Siegman, Mohammed Abu Nimer, please stand by. We're talking tonight about life after Yasser Arafat. It may be approaching soon. You can join the conversation. Has Arafat been the roadblock on the roadmap to peace, or has he been the unyielding representative of his people's desires? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight about life after Yasser Arafat, the Palestinian leader, in a French military hospital outside Paris tonight. And we have a new report, just a few minutes old now, from Agence France-Presse, saying that Yasser Arafat is in an irreversible coma, in a state of brain death, according to one news agency. Of course, we've had reports all through the day, and this is, well, not confirmed at this hour, but the very latest report. You can join this conversation tonight. Do you admire the man who fought for a Palestinian state all his life, or do you see him as having undermined the peace process and supported terrorism? Was Arafat used as a scapegoat for the failure to find peace? And what about Israel's responsibility and Washington's? And this, after Arafat, will prospects for peace improve? Will Washington and Israel step up Will the Palestinians be able to respond? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined tonight from New York by Henry Siegman, director of U.S. Middle East Project at the Council on Foreign Relations, former executive director of the American Jewish Congress, and from Falls Church, Virginia, by Muhammad Abu Nimer, professor at American University. Right now, Jay is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Jay. You're on the air.
Hello. First off, I'd like to say that I don't like to hear anybody in that type of condition. But I think Darif sold his people out for a number of years because he's just perpetuated the terrorism thing. There's generations to come that have hatred for just about anybody, even themselves. And I think if back 30 years ago, the first time he showed his face on TV, if they would have taken him out like most terrorists should be, I think they probably have a Palestinian state by now.
So a completely negative legacy in your view, Jay?
Oh, absolutely. He hasn't done anything for his people. You know, how he went from being a terrorist, which he still is, to being a so-called leader of a state, I just beyond me.
Jay, we've got it, and thank you for your call. I want to welcome to our conversation right now from Israel, from Tel Aviv, Barry Rubin. He's director of the Global Research and International Affairs Center, author of Yasser Arafat, A Political Diary. Barry Rubin, I know it's a terribly late hour there, but it's a special night, and we thank you for joining us. What's your sense of where we're headed post Yasser Arafat with Israel and the Palestinians, Barry Rubin?
Well, first, just I want to say the way you formulated your question, that I don't think Arafat really did fight for a Palestinian state. If he had decided to do that, history would have been quite different. I think that he fought for total victory and gave up and threw away the possibility of obtaining a state. And if he had taken that course, he would have accomplished it perhaps as early as the late 1970s. But you asked me specifically what's going to happen now. What's going to happen now is that the Palestinians are going to have to start seeking a new leadership. But first of all, if the reports that you just gave are correct, I want to stress the fact that as long as Mr. Arafat is alive, even if he is in a coma, I'm not sure that they will start moving on to new leadership. They might actually wait until such a point as he's still completely physically dead. Now, the problem is there are many problems. One problem is that Arafat has three major different jobs. So he has to be replaced in each of those jobs, and he could conceivably be replaced by different people. So that's a problem. Secondly of all, he's left a political culture of an organization which basically does not have discipline, does not have a clear chain of command, and it may well prove to be a legacy of chaos and disorganization. Even if someone is formally named as leader, how are they going to mobilize people to follow what they say when there are 10 or 20 other people who can claim to be a leader, when there are different factions, when there are different orientations? How is any decision going to be made, especially a decision to move toward a compromise peace when many of the groups and many of the factions are totally opposed to that? So it's going to, I think that the transition is going to take years until a new leader and a new clear hierarchy of power does emerge. I don't think this is going to happen quickly.
Barry Rubin, Henry Siegman is with us tonight and has suggested that Israel may have to move away from the unilateral plans that Ariel Sharon has laid out in recent months around Gaza and the West Bank to resume a peace process after Arafat, if that's what we're approaching. Can you see that happening?
Well, the fact is that a unilateral Israeli withdrawal is a big step toward what Palestinians say they want, which is Israel out. It's an opportunity for them to take over the governance of this territory and show what they can do. It's a tremendous opportunity. And the fact that Arafat never really prepared to set up an administration there and didn't view it as an opportunity but simply said this is a trick or in some cases this is a retreat is throwing away another opportunity. So for Israel to give up the withdrawal is not a step forward, it's a step
backward. Of course, if there was a Palestinian leadership that said we want to coordinate this more, then there could certainly be talks about the timing and how to do it and the details. And so I don't think people should wish for this withdrawal to be abandoned. I don't think that would be a step toward peace.
And Barry Rubin, finally, we heard earlier tonight from Rashid Khalidi saying, in his view, Yasser Arafat has been demonized over the years as a way of avoiding progress toward peace. What do you make of that?
Well, there are many times in history when you could say that. You could say Stalin was demonized to avoid, solving the Cold War. When you have an extremist leader on the other side who doesn't keep his commitments, it really makes it very difficult to make a deal. And when you're talking about, Saddam Hussein or any dictator or any extremist leader, it is genuinely difficult to deal with him. And in fact, Mr. Arafat was put to the test. He was rescued in 1991. He was given opportunities. No one in the modern history of the world has been given more opportunities and more second chances than Yasser Arafat. Finally, I have to add that if anyone talks to Palestinians and non-Palestinian Arabs privately, and Rashid knows this very well, that you don't hear them saying nice things about Yasser Arafat. I've never heard an Arab leader say nice things about Yasser Arafat. I've heard many people say they've never heard, and when you talk privately to Palestinians, they make it clear. So the public stance is, yes, he's a wonderful leader, he's a great hero, he's so terrific, but privately people are quite willing to admit that he has been a disaster as a leader, and he's been very harmful for their interests. And you see it now increasingly in the public opinion polls, and I think that a month after he's dead, people will start more and more publicly coming out and saying that.
Barry Rubin in Tel Aviv, thanks very much for spending a few minutes with us tonight.
Bye-bye.
Barry Rubin, Director of the Global Research and International Affairs Center. Mohammed Abu-Niber.
I have to say a few things.
Yes, please.
This is totally unfounded, the notion of privately and publicly and implying that the Arabs or the Palestinians are dishonest about their evaluation of Arafat. Since 1991 when Arafat came to Gaza, Palestinians have been criticizing him and calling for internal reform. The critique of Arafat even reached a point where people called for his resignation. So I don't think it's accurate to say that Palestinians privately or publicly did not criticize him. Tom?
Yes, I'm right here.
Yeah, the second point, I'm just amazed when you compare Arafat to Saddam Hussein and Stalin. On the other hand, you leave Sharon and Shamir. I mean, we're not dealing with angel called Sharon. Sharon was the one who witnessed the Sabran Shatila massacre of 1980 in Lebanon. Sharon and Shamir were both involved in terrorism prior to the state. So Arafat history and the Israeli leadership history is not as different. I'm continue to be amazed that somebody like Rubin, who did the biography on Arafat and he knows his history, cannot make this comparison of Sharon and Arafat and continue to deliberately ignore the history and position of Sharon and the Israeli government.
Mohammed Abu-Niber, let me take a call here. Jamal is calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Jamal, you're on the air.
Hi, good evening. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm an American of a Palestinian origin. I'm very proud of my origin as a Palestinian. Mm-hmm. For us as Palestinians, we respect Arafat in his death and in his life, but he's not the only Palestinian who is dying every day on the hand of the Israelis. There is many Palestinians that are dying every day, and when Arafat dies, it's not going to be the end of the Palestinians. I want to tell him, just ask Mr. Rubin and remind him the reason he lives in Israel, because he has all of those negative things to say about the Palestinians and the Palestinian leaders. The Palestinians are people of peace. And the Israelis, I don't think they have any intention of having peace at all.
Jamal, let me ask you. I hear your respect for Yasser Arafat. But when we look at the Palestinian situation tonight, as he struggles for his life, the Palestinian situation is not good. Does he bear some blame for that?
Yes, he does. But you have to understand, what makes the life difficult for Palestinians is not the life of Arafat. It's what the Israelis have on the ground. They're killing our brothers and sisters every day.
They're closing borders. They're destroying homes. And that's what people have to understand. It's not Arafat as the obstacle of peace. It's Sharon and the whole Israeli administration.
Jamal, thanks very much for calling in tonight. Mohammed Abu-Nimer, let me put to you what I guess it remains a basic question here, and that is whether Yasser Arafat's basic vision of his goal for the Palestinians was one that could coexist with an Israeli state.
I think this is an excellent question, and it does really help us to see the development of Arafat as a guerrilla leader, as a national leader, and as a diplomat. Arafat started with all Palestine or nothing, and I think he gave up that dream and he gave up that vision when he recognized Israel and two-state solution in, as back as November 15th, 1988. And I think his acceptance of Oslo, agreeing to go back and continue to negotiate with Israel toward a two-state solution, I think genuinely his vision to a Palestinian nationalist, that he has sovereignty in it. The fact that he could not find negotiators on the Israeli or the American side who could support toward the two-state solution is, I think, the disaster that he had to face. And the final sort of result of this was his confinement to 3 years. And as you said earlier, being scapegoated for a right-wing government in the U.S. and for a right-wing government in Israel. Unfortunately, here, let's remove Arafat. Arafat is to be ineffective in Palestinian politics. There is no Palestinian leader who can deliver an agreement according to Sharon of Gaza unilateral withdrawal or 42% of what Sharon is offering the Palestinian. There would be no Palestinian leader who will agree to what Sharon is offering. There need to be change, not in the Palestinian vision of two states. There need to be change in the Israeli government right away for Gaza is enough or for autonomy, limited autonomy to the Palestinian. I think that's what we need. We need to have a change in the... Now, the Palestinian side, there is no more justification for no leadership. You have a leadership. You have Mahmoud Abbas. You have Ahmed Korea. Both of them have sat with the Israeli, orchestrated Oslo, are in full agreement on two-state solution. Do you think, and everyone who's listening to this conversation, do you think that Sharon will agree to two-state solution with continuity of one Palestinian state without settlements? That's, I think, where the challenge is.
And today, President Bush saying that he continues to hope for a two-state solution. Do you expect greater U.S. involvement? We just got a half a minute left here, Mohammed Abu-Nimer, but with Yasser Arafat apparently incapacitated and perhaps on the edge of death, do you expect Washington to come back in?
I think, you know, I agree with Aaron Miller earlier that there is an opportunity here for the American administration to climb down from the tree that they stuck themselves on for the last 2-3 years. Arafat is out of the scene, and now it's a good time to go back and try to pressure on Sharon to deliver in more clearly a two-state solution. And I think the American administration desperately need progress on the Israeli-Palestinian track in order to cover for what's happening in Iraq. And I think that would be a very good strategy to move on.
Well, here we are, a historic moment. Yasser Arafat reportedly brain dead in Paris, and many peoples. Watch what comes next. Mohammed Abu-Nimer in Falls Church, Virginia, with American University. Thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.